Welcome to the Revenue Lounge, a podcast for revenue operations professionals who want to understand the various facets of this important go-to-market function. In each episode, the team at Nectar interviews revenue warriors on how they are reimagining revenue operations in creative and disruptive ways, and what are their secrets to building a scalable and predictable revenue engine. Let's get started.
Data is everywhere, but clarity is rare. As go-to-market teams scale, the challenge isn't information. It's unifying the data so that it's trusted and actionable. Siloed systems, disconnected signals, and misaligned goals often lead to what many RevOps leaders are forced to deal with, data chaos. The result? Missed opportunities, inconsistent buyer experiences, confused reps, and go-to-market leader misalignment. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revenue Lounge. I'm your host, Randy Likas, and in this episode, we will unpack what it takes to build a unified revenue engine, one that aligns teams, connects insights, and drives outcomes at scale. And joining me today is Alana Ballin. Alana is the Vice President of Revenue Operations at Sprout Social. She's got 15 years experience leading strategic operations and productivity teams to scale global SaaS organizations ranging from 10 million all the way up to 500 million plus, defining new sales strategies and new routes to market. Alana, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Randy. How are you?
I'm great. I usually like to start these conversations just learning a little bit more about you and a little bit about your career background and your current role at Sprout. And before we got started, I mentioned I loved your background because you started in sales. You started with grinding on the phones and you were an AE and then you got into ops. So maybe you can just tell us a little bit about your journey and, like I said, leading up to what you're up to right now at Sprout.
Absolutely. First, thanks for having me. It's so fun to be here. And we just had an SDR BDR offsite. And it's so fun to get to talk to people who are in the role now and say, hey, I was in your seat. I don't want to exactly go into the exact number of years it's been since then. But thinking back, that really was where I made lasting friendships and learned the foundation of the industry. I liken it to saying it's like starting in the mailroom, right? You just learn the ins and outs of the whole business. And I really fell into it. I was post-college. A friend of mine was working at Salesforce. It was a pretty small company at the time, medium-sized, recently public. And I needed a job. I needed to pay the bills. And he coached me for the interview. I got through the process. And I really fell in love. Right, all of the mechanics really made sense to me, and I loved talking to customers. I loved working with the team, working with AEs. And as I progressed my career, what I found was I really loved being around the revenue organization, but I liked to look at trends and problems that ran across deals. And so I sort of dipped in and out of sales a few times. I left SDR BDR to run enablement for a time at Salesforce, and then pivoted from there into being an AE because I really wanted to get that bag carrying experience. Ran my own firm for a while, consulting with other companies on building enablement strategies. So that combined selling, I was my only AE with my team of consultants. And although I loved being an external consultant and getting to see so many different companies like Okta and Dropbox, at the end of the day, I really missed being part of a team. I'm an athlete at heart, and I pivoted back in, joined Duo Security, started off with my bread and butter in enablement, but really always gravitated towards ops because every strategy I've ever built is related to how much revenue we're driving, how much churn and contraction we're saving. And I think that is unique in parts of the business, but always led me back towards doing something bigger and really being able to define like, hey, when should we go into new geographies? How will we maximize new products? So I got a chance to cut my teeth at Duo and doing some go-to-market strategy and then joined Wiz and obviously got to see several phases of company there. And once that journey had come to an end, there were a couple of things I still wanted to learn. I love learning and I really relished the opportunity at Sprout to get back to work with some of the people I worked with many years ago at Salesforce, but also to work at a publicly traded company, right? That is a whole different ball game. And I'm learning a ton about how does that information flow and what is it that we need to do as we think about shifting strategy to continue to give that predictability.
So what is it that excited you about the opportunity at Sprout? Because, you know, I speak with a lot of leaders and I think there's one thing that's consistent is that leaders like yourself are never really brought in to do things, to keep things the same, right? They're brought in to make an impact and make some changes. And the Sprout had their earnings call last week and they talked about things like, you know, winning the enterprise and cross-selling our products and expanding within our products. So there's a lot of really, I think, big strategic things that are going on. But what was it specifically that got you excited about the opportunity?
I think first is relationships. Michael, the CRO, was my boss many years ago at Salesforce. He and I have continued to have a great relationship, and I really embraced his vision as well as Ryan Bretto, the CEO, who I worked with also at Salesforce, right? I think search is dead. We see that across the industry for all of our customers, and the way that people are interacting and finding companies and the way that people are consuming information, similarly on the news front, right? So you have news and media changing rapidly. You have search, which has been the bedrock of demand, changing rapidly. And of course, you have AI that goes across all of it, right? And so I think Sprout's at this really incredible intersection of all of those three motions and really allowing organizations to reinvent themselves rapidly. And by the way, like, that's companies and that's also nonprofits. Even in the midst of all of the global upheaval and changes, right, there's a lot of types of organizations that are really looking at how is social the way that we mainly get our message out into the public square. So that was really fascinating to me. And I think that that is continuing to evolve and change. I was just really impressed with the team that they put together. And to be able to say at this size, like, hey, now we want to grow and change and evolve. I think that was really interesting, right? You kind of go through the rapid growth and then you get to what people typically get to. You get to that inflection point at a certain size. And it's like, okay, now we have to change and do things differently to get bigger. And that's what I really wanted to do. It was like, the products are always extremely interesting to me. So I always want to go somewhere where I'm passionate about how the product is changing and evolving. And then do I think it's the team that can do it? And does the company have the appetite for change?
Yeah. Well, and certainly Sprout has grown tremendously over the past several years. And with the ambitious goal of being a $1 billion company, there's lots of things ahead and change as well. Any surprises when you walked in? Like, you go in, you inherit an infrastructure, an environment. Anything that you immediately saw is like, wow, I didn't think about it like this. Or even maybe low-hanging fruit where you're like, oh, this is a really immediate way to improve some things.
I think that's true of any organization, right? Yeah. You always are coming in and you're looking at it with fresh eyes. And you're like, trying to figure out, how did we get here? How do we think about it? What is it that we want to do? And I think that this kind of gets back to what I was saying before about an organization ready for change. Sometimes when you are coming in with a new group of leaders, there is a big resistance to change. And I think that was probably my biggest surprise. It's like, everyone is really hungry and thirsty for it, right? Like, everyone wanted to see what are the things we need to do to get to a billion, right? And so that to me is the most amazing thing. It's like, we've been able to make a tremendous amount of progress because we have had that, right? A couple of years ago, Sprout acquired Tagger. We've really just exploded that strategy and really enhanced that product. Just an incredible team there. And that is really where we are leading the way with a lot of companies coming to us to say, like, how do I do this influencer thing right? You know, like, I'm done spending a ton of money on ads. I want to understand, like, who are the influencers? How do I get into all the markets? So I think that appetite for change has allowed us to move really quickly. And I think the other piece on this, and it's not a surprise because I talked to a number of customers before I joined, but people feel really dedicated to their relationship with Sprout. Like, it really comes down to the people. The product continues to evolve and is fantastic, but it really is about the people, and that's what the customers say over and over again. And that's not something that you can operationalize, right? That is either exists or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And that makes my job easier. You can layer in the things you need to if you have the right team with the right vision.
And you opened it up, search is dead, right? And influencer marketing is so important. And the fact that with the Tagger acquisition that you're kind of leading the way, and it's just, I agree. It's a wonderful opportunity. So congratulations. You've been there, what, about 6 or 8 months now?
6 months, yeah. No, almost, like, almost, I count it by, you know, end of months, end of quarters. But yeah, almost 7.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into the topic that we want to do is unpack this idea of a unified revenue engine. If you look across the marketing and sales tech stack, so much data is siloed within different tools, and a lot of it's available. It's just not necessarily easy to tie together. So my question would be, what does unified revenue engine mean to you? And why do you think it is such a challenge for many organizations to unify their data?
You know, I think it's all about incentives, right? People always, I think, make fun of salespeople. Are like, oh, coin operated. But it's actually like, that's why it's so easy to work with sales organizations, because if you incent them in the right way, you will get the behavior that you are looking for if you have people that are truly incented by that. And so I think that everyone is motivated by incentives. Not all of them are financial. And so for me, the unified data engine is, and the unified revenue engine and the unified revenue data engine, right? It's all three parts, is really important because you need to align the incentives for your whole organization.
Yeah.
Right? You need to make sure that you have reps who aren't saying, oh, that customer churned 1 month and the next month I'm going to sell them again. Right? You need to put things in place so that everyone is incented to do what's right for the customer and the company. And that starts to make sure they feel like we're doing the right thing for them. And so I think that when you have competing parts of the organization, that kind of breaks, right? And so when you have a unified revenue engine, everyone's working towards the same goal. Everyone's making sure that churn is low, right? Everyone this year, especially with the way that the economy has been a little bit tumultuous, is hugging their customers, right? They're doing everything they can to keep every customer in the boat, and you need your entire organization behind that goal.
Yeah.
You need the entire organization behind the goal of growing all of those customers, right? And you need to make sure that message is coming through to prospects that like, hey, when you become part of our family, you're a part of this. And the only way that the organization can do that is if you can present them the information they need to do their job, right? It's like, if I have to go over here to get one thing and over here to get another thing and the data isn't the same and it conflicts, right? If you're working with different sources and it's not all coming from the same place, you could end up with different conclusions. And that happens, right? That is a big piece. I also think in the times where things were just going up and up and up for all of tech, people were just buying tools.
Yeah.
Right? You're like, this one tool is going to get us there. This one tool. So you've got this Frankenstein of tools doing all sorts of things to your data, right? And you may or may not have put in place good governance and policies, right? Can everyone create accounts? Or is that a real streamlined process? How are leads entering? What's the marketing and sales handoff? And how does that tool flow work? So I think all of those things, if you can get that right, it makes your entire team more productive. Not just that, everyone every day is like AI, right? Of course, like everyone else, like AI, trying to get AI SDRs and AI revenue ops analysts. And we have all of these different operators working in our business. If your data is bad,
yeah,
then AI cannot work.
That's right.
Right? So it not just prevents your team from being productive, but it prevents you from actually innovating and outperforming your competitor.
Yeah. And it's interesting, data, when you say data is bad, it's not even just the cleanliness. That is important, but it's the connectedness to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that the different data sets are able to be correlated together.
Yeah.
Before we dive deeper into that, I want to ask you a question, because we talked about like the incentives, and we talked about the reps. But I think what we're seeing a lot right now is even at the individual go-to-market function leadership level, there's marketing's responsible for pipeline and marketing sourced and sales is responsible for, but there needs to be alignment and incentive across those functions so that we're aligned on core, you know, common objectives that lead to the outcomes that we want as a business. But so many companies struggle with that, right? They're still kind of operating in what I'm responsible for. I guess the question is, are you also seeing that, not necessarily Sprout, but as you talk to other leaders, is that a challenge that you're hearing as well? And how do you overcome that?
You know, I feel like I'm saying the same theme, and so I don't want to bore the listeners, but it really comes down to the people, right? Yeah. If everybody agrees that we're trying to do the best for the entire company, a lot of that disappears. So like we cross-functionally gather sales, channel, marketing, different parts of marketing to really look at where we're doing from a pipeline perspective. And it's really at every level. What is every team doing across every source? But it's not about, oh, you're bad for this team, so shame on you, figure it out. It's like, okay, this team is behind total. Like this other source is working. What are the levers that we're going to pull? And so that meeting is less about who's doing well and who's doing poorly and more about what is it that we're going to do? Right? What are additional SKUs that we're going to put in place from the product team? How are we going to evolve what we're doing on the marketing side? How are we going to change some of our top of funnel demand? So there's a lot of different pieces. And I think that sort of continual work together. And then we go together as one team to our executives, to our CRO and our CMO and say, hey, this is our joint plan. And we're all in this together. Yeah. I do think a lot of it comes from the top of like, hey, what are we trying to do? Number one, I think number two, you really never want to be in a situation where one team is celebrating and the other team is not, right? I think we've all been there where marketing's like, we crushed it, so I don't know what's wrong with you guys. And look, that really relies on the modeling. It kind of comes back to the data, as we talked about. It's like really building a strong foundation of, these are our actual conversion rates. This is where we actually think that we can improve next year. Is it in top of funnel? Is it in SQL to SAO, right? Like, where are the places that we think we can pull the levers? And being really honest about that and really interrogating your model as you go through the year, right? Like, hey, we're doing really well against one of the things we plan in the model, and one other part of the model, like, we're not. So it's like, well, which part of the model needs to change, and how does that impact maybe a mid-year replan or our plan for next year? Yeah. And so I think even in that building process, it has to be really collaborative, because if you plan really separately, then you can't execute together. So it really is about collaborating all the way through the process. And like every model and every plan, everyone is like, I'm not super happy with that, but I would have to live with it, right? That disagree and commit, that really is the hallmark. So I think that's been serving us well. And I really credit my boss, Mike Wolf, for this. It's changing so fast, right? We are completely reimagining what we're doing from a BDR perspective. The BDR of days when I was a BDR, like, that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
So really being open to like, hey, we're going to work on this motion. We're going to change this motion. What does that mean for the model and for the results? You know, it's like companies, you got to be able to take those risks, and then we got to be able to pull up other areas of the pipeline for it.
Yeah. You were starting to touch on this a little bit, and I've heard you talk about this idea of the watermelon, right? When you change
Ryan Carlson, I feel like I have to give him credit forever.
I love it.
Now much higher in organization.
Yeah. For the benefit of our listeners, can you just step through that analogy and what that the slice of the watermelon is?
Yes. So I met Ryan Carlson first at Okta. We worked together at Wiz. Now he's at ChainGuard running that organization. And in one of the first pipeline reviews I ever did with him, he said, you have to slice the watermelon. Right? Because all the time you're like, oh, I'm hitting my pipeline target, right? And you're like, yes, I need 2 million in pipeline, or I need 10 million in pipeline. I am there. 100 million, whatever it is that you need, a billion. I'm there. He's like, you have to slice the watermelon. You have to know how you're doing by source and by team, right? It's like, am I really making hay? Is it all the AEs? Is it all marketing? Of course, we could have the attribution discussion until the end of time. But also, what's happening in APAC? What's happening in Europe? What's happening in my different segments? Maybe I'm doing great in enterprise globally, but I'm not doing well in commercial, or maybe the reverse, right? And so really looking at that granular level will help you diagnose what exactly is happening. Is it a top of funnel issue? Is it more AE generated, right? Once you really understand what's happening, then you can say, okay, hey, we need to put more spend in specifically Australia and New Zealand. We need to launch a sales campaign that's specifically targeted to our Benelux or our LATAM team, right? That really helps you understand whether you're ahead and behind. You might be ahead, but maybe it's really like in one particular area, and it's obfuscating a bigger problem that you have.
Yeah.
We've probably all been there. We've had a couple of reps pipe really big deals, and you think you're golden, and then you lose those two deals and you're in real bad shape. The other thing I'm very passionate about this year in particular is volume versus value, right? It's not just about looking at it by segment and by geo. It's also about looking at volume and value, right? What's happening right now is that people are understandably very nervous about all spend. And so I think that we will see more value compression through the cycle. Again, I think that's not really specific to what I'm doing right now. It's like the trends that I see from the different groups that I'm in the market of like how people are looking at things. And that means that the volume is exceedingly important, because some of the assumptions that you make through your model in terms of conversion rates and conversion value may not hold.
Yep.
So that's my thing this year, is really making sure I'm looking at the right volume.
So I want to unpack the volume thing a little bit more, because I think we talked about the SDRs and the changes that you all are making through whether you use a sales engagement platform or not. The problem that's happened over the past couple of years is people basically abuse them, and they use them as spam cannons, and they send out all this volume and they're all generic. And I think what's happening from a buyer's perspective, if you look at, I'm sure your inbox is similar to mine, you just get all these like messages that your mental spam filter is like, nope, 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 right? And because of the pressures that we're all under in business, the sort of the knee-jerk reaction is, well, we got to do more, right? We got to do more with less. And everybody's trying to do more, but I feel like that's hitting to a point of diminishing returns.
Agreed.
And we've got to start doing some things that are a little bit different, right?
Mm-hmm.
What role does RevOps play, and you as a RevOps leader, have in challenging the organization or your partners on, we've got to do, you know, thinking of the value thing, which is the volume is important. We have to have certain, we also have to do things a little bit differently.
Yep.
We'd love to get your perspective on that.
So I think when I think about volume, I'm thinking about opportunity volume and lead volume. But I think in terms of, we got really focused with SDRs and BDRs for many years on volume of activity.
Yeah.
And by the way, volume of activity is very important, but the quality of that activity is more important now than ever. So I think this is where the AI provides a big unlock. It's like, you can do the same volume of activity, but you can't do the same value of activity. You cannot send a generic email to 300 people and 30 of them will say, sure, I'd love to talk to you.
Yep.
Right? You really have to deliver value in each interaction. And I think every product can do this. I think it's really easy for us to do that, right? Because we have so much data available. So the quality of the activity has to change, and we have the ability with AI, and particularly at Sprout, we have the ability with the data that we can see on the customers that we're targeting to deliver them value in every prospecting interaction, right? Like, we can see how their brand is performing. We can see what their competitors are saying. I read a lot of news, and I was reading about a company called Spiceology, right? And they just launched this cool new campaign where they want people to create their own spice blends, and it's a contest. And I was like, well, that's a perfect opportunity for us to say, hey, let me show you how that campaign is already performing, mm-hmm. right? Instead of saying, hey, do you want to use Sprout to manage that campaign? You can say, here's how you did this week. Did you see, is that the spike you were predicting, right? We can do that with pretty much any campaign a customer's running. We can do that with anything that's in the news for any customer. And then we can really do that for any brand at any time. Like, hey, this is what we're noticing. Here's what we see about competitors. Here's how a topic that's trending in your space. And so by providing that value, that's driving the interaction, not the, hey, do you want to look at our platform?
Yeah.
And I think that's the big change. Think about, like, similarly, there are things that you can see publicly for companies, even in security, right? So there's different things. You have to really differentiate yourself by saying, I already know about your organization and I already know how I can help you. It's different than Challenger, where it's like, you're not doing things right, right? And here's how you could do it better. It's about like, hey, here's something you could take to your boss right now.
Yeah. It's a point of view. It's helping them think about their business a little bit differently that they haven't thought about mm-hmm. in the past. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then from an operational cadence, as you think about the driving some of this change, what do you see works best? Is it a quarterly type of thing? Is it monthly? What's the best way to look at how we drive this value or how we make the changes in the system that RevOps can lead?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Look, we are running a lot of experiments all the time. And what I would say is we look at it I look at daily, weekly, monthly, and quarterly. What am I looking for daily? I'm looking for how many of that quality outreach are we doing, right? Like, we have different campaigns that we're activating. And so it's like, what is the uptake in that campaign? Some of it is qualitative review, right? We always want to shout out our reps who are doing an incredible job. That really the things that they come up with, I could never be an SDR BDR today because I'm not as creative as they are. But really combining the qualitative with the quantitative, shouting it out and replicating it and looking for those leading indicators like quality activity. Like, okay, it's like last week we booked 10 meetings from this. This week we booked 50 meetings from it. And looking at what is the volume of activity that creates both volume and value of opportunities on a weekly, monthly, and quarterly basis. And then how are those progressing through the funnel? Because prospecting, like, cold opportunities are harder.
Yeah. Well, so in the green room, we talked a little bit about the distilling the noise, because while everyone bought all these different tools and systems, and I think people are starting to rationalize that spend and bring it down a little bit, what we're still seeing is your ABM platform is giving you one set of signals, Sprout's giving you the social, the influential signals, your marketing automation system's doing one thing, your CRM's over here. And so we have to help the reps make sense of it all, right? And because it's kind of siloed, it's hard to do. What are your thoughts on how do you distill that noise and how do you make sense of all the different data sources that aren't necessarily talking to one another?
I mean, I think it's really hard, right? I would love to tell you we figured it out. I think there's an element of like a custom layer that you can create. There are tools that do that, right? It's hard to justify another tool that aggregates the signals. I think you do see people starting to pull away from some of the tools that are more signal heavy that you get a lot of false positives from. I'm very bullish on a tool called Sumble. I've worked with Anthony Goldblum for a long time, and we aren't using it today in full at Sprout, but I think that's really the goal, is like, how do we take a lot of that away? Look, in the next 2 years, every role in sales is going to be transformed, right? And that ability to have essentially an AI operator say, okay, based on every piece of data, go after this account right now and say this. And people still crave that human connection. So I don't think that the sales organization is going anywhere. They still want to understand. Like, they're still not going to trust they're going to get all the right data from an AI chatbot, essentially, or an AI salesperson. But I think you're going to see that the sellers will have to become more technical, right? They're going to be more of a technical seller, more SE and CSM oriented, right? Because it's going to be that real specialized value they're going to create. But that is really where I hope to see the AI operators, where I think we'll win. I don't know that we'll need a revenue platform to do this, right? I think you can use a generic tool to say, okay, I've taken in everything from, let's just say, today's stack, right? From your website, from Gong, from your product, from Sixth Sense, from Marketo, right? If you look at all the things coming in from today's stack, you're like, here's where all the signals are. LinkedIn Sales Navigator, like, here's all the signals and this is the account, go, right? And then you remove all the time the rep is spending, and here's a brief on all of the research, right? Now, today, you're still saying, hey, use this GPT or use this Gem for Gemini to say, okay, this account is signaling, what do I say? So the rep is still doing a lot of that. Like, 10 months, the operator will do the whole thing for them.
Yeah. How do you think the metrics are going to change, or will they change at all in this new world?
Everyone is always having to make everybody more productive, right? I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with self-service. Will people self-serve more? We have already seen that buyers come to us later. But I think there's still, especially for a certain amount of spend, you still want to have that connection of, okay, I'm going to invest in this. If it breaks, who's going to help me? I need a person who's going to help me. I can't just blindly pay $10,000 on a website without talking to a human being. That's extremely rare. Although in some cases where it's like very strong product-led growth and your spend grows over time, that may happen. I think that productivity is going to be really leaned on. What is it that you're doing with humans? What is it that you're not doing with humans? And what is it that is becoming specialized? I do think that it's hard to quantify all the time sales productivity, because salespeople they're not hooked up to a machine that's logging what they're doing every minute. But I do think it really is about, what are we seeing per person and how much time are they able to spend with customers versus the other things that they are having to do?
Yeah.
I think you're also going to see enablement change a lot, right? It's like, I'm a big fan of 2-minute Loom videos, like 2-minute videos on WorkRamp, right? Like, people are just like that just in time, right? You're in the sales cycle and it's like, hey, this is all the information you need. It's not like, I need to pull customer information and competitive information and this and product. It's like, it's all served up for you automatically, is the dream.
Yeah. The thing that you spoke about earlier about changes that you're making with your SDR team, I want to call out a trend that we're seeing quite often, is this recognizing that the individual lead and the MQL is flawed. And there's so much waste because we know that the buying decisions are being made much different, right? Yep. People are able to do a lot more self-service on their own. I think Sixth Sense's research says like people are getting about 70% of the way through the journey before they even want to talk to Sal. And so there's this idea of, let's move away from the MQL is how we measure pipeline and move to a buying group motion, right? And buying group is a kind of a nebulous term, because if you talk to sales, they'll say, we've always been doing buying groups. Yes. It's called multi-threading.
Multi-threading. My sales leaders hit me over the head to multi-thread. Yep.
Right. But in this context, it's more like opportunity-based marketing, right? Where we're creating these early stage zero opportunity containers that will not necessarily have just the people that score up, but maybe if we see a swarming going on in the account, we may want to put the people that scored up, but maybe the people that didn't score up as well into this opportunity container, and then go look at maybe historical opportunities where we've had the organization and look at who the deal influencers are and pipe those into these early stage opportunity containers. And there's been a lot of Forrester's really big on the topic. If you go to any one of the speaking circuits, the early adopters are showing just incredible improvements in conversion and win rates and deal size and everything else. But not too many companies have made the leap, right? There's a lot of interest, but they're just not quite there yet. There's this movement towards this different way of doing top of funnel. We'd love to get your thoughts on that. And then second, why do you think companies maybe have, even though all these great results are being shown, what's prohibiting companies from maybe moving a little bit faster?
So I'll start with your second question, which is, I think it's hard. It gets back to where we started with the revenue data engine, right? To do buying groups well, you have to have good data.
Yeah.
You have to be able to know how to target people. Also, I think there's a hesitancy around relationships, right? I'm talking to this person. How are they going to feel if I go around them or above them or this and that? And we talked a little bit about incentives, right? People are driven by incentives, and it's, if somebody comes inbound and talks to you, that's the easy button. I think that overall, we talked about what interested me about the opportunity in Sprout, and a big part of it was I think it's become a board level problem.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that you'll see a more of a movement to buying groups when it becomes a board level problem, right? As we see search diminishing, and that contributes to companies, like we hear it from our customers every day, like people are finding us through social. They're not finding us through search. And how do I navigate that? And how do I make sure that I don't disrupt my pipeline, right? So until they really feel that acute pain and the board is like, well, this is a real problem, you aren't going to really be able to see that full shift. And so when I think about what does it take to really get there, the answer really can't be at this point just like more tools and more and more and more, right? And so I think we have to really think about what does it mean to move to buying groups, right? To your point, like sales, we've already been doing that. It's called multi-threading, right? But bringing that motion earlier in the process. And what I think about, especially, I saw a brilliant post on LinkedIn, and I feel terrible that I can't reference who it was. It was a rep who was like, everybody I talk to, I add them to my newsletter. They can always opt out. And it's just like their thoughts on their industry and the trends. So they're always top of mind. And eventually those people come back, right? And so when I think about buying groups, I think about creating a nurture cycle earlier. Individuals move on from companies, company initiative change, people change roles within companies. Yeah. So if you start nurturing a buying group earlier, someone will come back to you at some point, right? Or maybe the person who's tasked with evaluating it, it's not their top priority, but it's someone else's. And so I think what is exciting to me is I think it further aligns sales and marketing, right? Right? We've been doing this the whole time. Like, Mark, we had to give it a better name. But really, it's about extending, instead of waiting for the salesperson to say, well, how's the director going to be involved? And how do you get budget? And what is the process for approval from the board? It's like, pull that whole piece forward to say, hey, you have certain needs. I'm sure the people you're working with have certain needs. So let's start nurturing that whole conversation. It just makes, look, where you're multi-threaded, you're more likely to win. So if you pull that motion forward, you're going to win.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's an important skill when you're an SDR BDR, not just let's set the meeting, but hey, let's make this the most productive for your team. Who are the people that should be there? Right? And really making sure when someone's coming inbound, inbound is just a signal to go outbound.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you came inbound, but let's start to go out to the other people so that we're having the right conversation.
Yep.
Or that we're not wasting time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what you said is dead on. I'll add an additional perspective, which is I think that to move to an opportunity-based marketing motion, we have to have good data to help us get there because everything is siloed. We think, how many times has marketing said, well, we made all these investments in a campaign, and other than the hand raisers, we don't know who's involved in the opportunity, right? And the people that we've targeted certainly may well be in that buying decision, but because historical opportunity, if you look at any historical opportunity or even any active deal, you might have one or two people on that deal, but everybody else who's come in and out is off of that. How does marketing then know who do we have to help go drive on this to move the deal forward? And it just goes back to the challenge, I think, with having unified data, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The need to get there.
Yeah. And I would go even further because we talked a lot about like marketing campaigns, like ABM, demand. I pull in product marketing, right? It's like, how well do you know your ICP?
Yep.
Right? You got to be at the practitioner, at the leader level, and then at the board level. You have to know what is the value you're delivering at every stage, because that's what these conversations are now. Like, just assume everything, every purchase has to be justified to the board.
Yeah. So for those listeners who are struggling with unifying their data, and
who's not? I mean, if it's a be shorter to say, who is not struggling?
There's no such thing as perfect, right? We're always working there. But for those that are not able to connect those dots, practical advice might you give? Where should people start? What's the low-hanging fruit? And what's the North Star that you think we should all get to?
You know, I think that it is different at every company, right? The problem is different at every company. Do you have a duplicates problem? Is it just that you can't tell what's real? Do you have a problem where success and sales are not unified, so they're both calling different customers, right? I think it's really about starting. I call this the daisy chain, and maybe you've heard me say that before, but it's like, start with what is your presenting business problem? And it is different, right? If you start with what's wrong with our data, you might not solve the right problem, right? But you really have to start with, like, is it that our reps can't work because they don't know if this is their account or not? Is it that we don't know if this person is interested in this product because we can't see what they're doing in the product? Is it that customer success is somewhere else and they just called the customer, right? Like, we had an incident this week where one person on my team showed up and said, hey, this is the proposal they gave us for the expansion. And then my CRO said, I happened to be in the office when that same vendor did a presentation and it bombed. So how am I going to go to him with the big, you know, it's like, I want to go back to that company and be like, y'all gotta talk. Do y'all talk? They both sent me emails like, hey, we sent this proposal. Hey, so sorry the training didn't go well. And I'm like, hello, everyone. Right? And I have empathy for that problem, right? But it really is about what problems is the data creating, and that's where you start. Because you can design the best data architecture and the best system flow of data, but if it's going to take you 18 months to get there, it's going to have all changed by then.
Yeah.
So it's really about what is the problem? Like, for a variety of reasons, many years ago, we had had an issue where the United States populated as the country in a lot of records. And that was incorrect. And that's where I started. It's like, hey, I want to know, these are accounts assigned in Europe. I want the right country in Europe on them so that we can see how we're doing by country and that the reps know, like, hey, I am taking a trip and I'm going to Amsterdam. Who are the customers that I'm going to see in Amsterdam, right? There's a variety of things. So it sounds small.
Yeah.
But it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And by the way, we were able to show a win. Be like, okay. So we just hired someone to help us overall with data. And he asked me the same question. He's like, where should I start? And I was like, look, I would love to say that you should come in and just do it all at once. But I love incremental work. Really credit Jim Sib, who is our leader at Duo. He always like, just show me iterative work. Show me that you can take it down, show a business impact. Because you have the danger of saying, like, we're going to fix all the data. And you do this ivory tower, big bang thing, and it doesn't work. So
completely misses what the executive side is. Yeah.
Find a business problem that is tangible, that is small, fix it, and be like, okay, what did I learn? And how can I extrapolate that to a bigger problem?
Yep. So RevOps works differently in different organizations. Some are seen as very strategic. Some are seen as the order takers and the problem solvers. So for those that want to get the seat at the table and be the strategic, what advice might you give folks to get there?
I feel like this would be a little controversial, but it's really about the leader that you're working with. I am an empowered person, but really the number one thing when I'm interviewing that I look for is, what is our relationship going to be like, right? What is the CRO RevOps leader relationship like? And I think for people who are more junior who are interviewing, for sure meet the head of RevOps, meet someone in sales and have them understand, like, how do you work together?
Yeah.
What is your perception, right? You get an email from a leader who's like, I need you to do X. I'm like, come with questions, right? Hey, I'm noticing this in the business. I don't know if it's right. Here's my hypothesis. What do you think, right? That's what we want to cultivate, but it does come from how the CRO and head of RevOps work together and other leaders, head of customer, the chief customer officer or head of customer success, right? What is the relationship modeled from the top?
Yeah.
And then I think it does get into the tactics, right? Like, you have to put good policies and processes in place so that you're not bogged down by manual things you have to do that's taking up 80% of your team's time,
yep.
Right? So you want to understand, how is the team spending their time and what are the examples? I will give you one example. We have an amazing team of analysts, and every month they would do a retro. And we have this incredible new analytic guy on our team. Shout out to Bolu. And I said, hey, Bolu, I want you to take all of their requirements and I want you to automate the creation of one retro file. So now across all of our business, every geo, every segment, every go-to-market, he on like day two has a data pack. They see all their metrics. And then when they see trends in their business, then they're like, oh, I need to dig into that. Mm-hmm. So then they're able to take that, and instead of each of them spending time doing the analysis, we do it one time. Then they dig into just the areas that are important. And what drives the conversation is, hey, these are the issues for us, and these are the things we need to do about them. And that cycle is happening much faster because we're doing it once. Yeah. Right. And so those are the types of things that I'm excited that we can unlock.
Yeah. No, I think that's really great practical advice. And thanks for sharing that. I want to transition to our lightning round, which is a little bit more lighthearted and fun and personal. But before I do that,
should I say first, I'm not fun?
No, you're great.
It's okay. I don't feel bad about it. I'm a more serious kind of gal.
I'll start with some softballs and we'll kind of
get
from there. Okay. First one, real easy. I read that your family is a very big football family, that your grandmother, I think, really enjoyed football, and it's really multi-generational. Who's your team?
49ers. Okay. I'm a fourth-generation 49er fan.
Oh, is that right?
But I should say a couple things. My number one team of my whole heart and life for every sport is UCLA. I love UCLA forever for all things.
Yeah. How do you think the 49ers are going to do this year?
I don't know. Check out Dieter Kurtenbach. He is a columnist for the Mercury News, and every time he's always the wet blanket. I try to go into every season with a degree of optimism. I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. And on the downside is I love football, but I also head injuries have kept me on the fence about it. But it also just brings a community together, right? You're in your neighborhood, everyone's like wearing Niners colors. And again, I've been a Niners fan for over 40 years. So we've had some highs and we've had some lows, and always hope springs eternal. So fingers crossed.
Yep. All right. So next question. What's the favorite part about your job? Not necessarily at Sprout because you're still relatively new, but what's your favorite part about being a leader in revenue operations?
Hiring people that are smarter than me and learning from them. Truly, like, you see people blossom in their careers and do things that you couldn't even imagine, right? You're like, wow, that is really cool. Can you teach me how to do that? So just being able to unlock that potential, and it has huge impacts across organizations.
What's the one quality that you look for when you're interviewing someone that you think is extremely important in RevOps?
It is maybe overutilized, but I look for grit, right? Like, you got to not care that salespeople are mad or angry or this or that. You got to ride the waves, right? Sometimes we do well and sometimes we do poorly. And our job is to create a situation in which we do as well as we can and keep the boat as stable as we can. So I really look for that kind of perseverance and grit where it's like, if it gets tough, that you can keep going. The other thing that I look for, and this is more a leadership quality I look for, is I really look for the ability to telescope. Some people are really good about talking about the high-level problems and the strategy and really bad about breaking that down into programs, projects, execution, and KPI measurements. Yeah. And so I look for the ability, like, some days I'm up here presenting to executives, and some days I'm like building reports and trying to fix fields in Salesforce, right? So you really have to be able to go up and down. And that's the most powerful skill you can have as a RevOps leader and a RevOps individual, is an AI can help with this. I said this to somebody yesterday, throw your deck into ChatGPT, ask them how to help make it better for an executive audience.
Yep.
Because all of those skills are important, right? If you're just down here doing the work, you're not building your brand and you're not really speaking to the business problems. Yep. So you've got to be able to go up and down.
Yep. I love that. Okay. Flip side to the favorite part of your job question is, what is the least favorite, or asked a different way, what's really hard about being a RevOps leader?
I think the hardest part about being any leader is people management, right? I love the development side when it's going great, but it doesn't always go great, right? And no one likes that, but it's like parenting. I always say to my team, do you want to win or do you want to be right? That comes from Barry Ryan, who was a trainer that I worked with many, many years ago, right? I would rather win than be right. And that keeps that, a lot of that conflict away. So you can win and be wrong if your model was wrong, but you still get the results, right? Or the assumptions you made, or where you thought the revenue is going to come from. The worst part of the job is being wrong and not winning.
Right.
Like, right? If you're wrong and you win, no one notices. When you're wrong and it doesn't work, right? You make a bet and it doesn't pan out. Like, that is the worst part of the job. Like, you let the organization down. Of course, there's a lot of factors, but that is the worst part of the job.
And you may have answered this a little bit when you told me about what you look for in the interview quality, but if someone is listening to this and they're maybe younger in their career, maybe an analyst, and they're working their way up, but they want to have your job someday, what's the one piece of advice that you would give them?
I am a really good generalist, right? And the reason why, like, if you talk to any of my former consulting clients or the CROs I've supported, right, they're like, Alana's really good about figuring out what are the big things that we need to focus on and what are the things we don't need to do. And I think that's the important part, right? It's like, something might upset you, a rule of engagement conflict. Some rep did something they shouldn't have done, right? You've got to let it go.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the hard part, is it's going to figure out a way to like truly not sweat the small stuff, because it takes energy and time from the important things. Right. It's like, I was dealing with this with somebody the other day where they were like, this is wrong. I'm like, I agree that it's wrong. We're in 100% alignment. And the most important thing to me right now is revenue. So let's let that be wrong. And let's focus on how do we get to the end of the month? Because we were in a really critical time where we're like trying to knock the deals down. I think that being able to do that focus, that doesn't mean being like, oh, I'm not going to do that because I have to do this, right? It's like just really being efficient with your time, which can be hard to do. I think RevOps are some of the best work from homers, but just being really laser focused on what are the things you need to get done and get to know all the parts of the business.
Yep.
Again, I couldn't be an analytics standalone person. I probably could be enablement standalone, but a lot of the other functions, business partner, right? Get to know all the parts of the org, be dangerous, understand how they're all interconnected.
Love that. Okay, last question. What is one piece of advice that you got maybe early in your career that still sticks with you today?
Oh, there's so many to choose from. The one that I think really jumps out at me is Tony Rodoni, when I was leaving Salesforce, said, just know that not everywhere is like this place. Right? I had been there for my early career. I'd been there for almost 7 years. I had a couple of jobs, but that was really my first real full-time job out of college. And it was a really special place at that time. We're doing something extremely innovative, moving people to use software on the web that they didn't even know they could do. It was growing really fast. And there was a lot of different products and acquisitions and a really well-oiled operational machine focused on go-to-market. And I think that a lot of people take that for granted. When you're in a really special place, you think, oh, this is how everywhere is. And so that really makes me, when I go into a company or I'm working with different companies, think about like, what is unique about this company, right? I don't expect the same thing or the same set of circumstances. I don't think it's me that brought the magic, right? Like, oh, I will be the first to say that about Wiz. It's like, I knew that it was an amazing product. I knew the founders were a whole other level of brilliant. And I just hitched my wagon to them, right? Like that. Like I was smoking if you got them, right? Like fish in a barrel, like this was the right thing at the right time. And that was true of Salesforce, right? So it's like, how do you identify that? And then how do you implement the processes, programs, and policies to maximize it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you're giving yourself a little undervalued credit, because that company has grown so much over the past several years. Fantastic exit recently. But those systems break very easily with that kind of growth. And so you had to put the right systems in place. I really appreciate your time today. I think it was really good conversation, very insightful. And I love a lot of the pragmatic advice that you had given. So thanks so much for joining. That's another episode of the Revenue Lounge. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.